Hello, this is Internet Governance Explained. We are Johanna and Ann-Kathrin, and today we will talk about platform governance. Our guest is Clara Iglesias Keller, a postdoctoral legal scholar who is currently a research fellow at the Social Science Center of Berlin and the Leibniz Institute for Media Research in Hamburg, where she conducts research on platform governance, politics of digitalization, and regulatory strategies of disinformation. For joining us today on our talk about platform governance, and we're very happy to have you here and learn from your expertise. And maybe you could start with introducing yourself to the audience.
Thank you so much for inviting me. My name is Clara. I'm a postdoctoral legal scholar originally from Brazil, and I've been living in Berlin for the past almost 3 years now. I'm happy to share some of the work that I do in these three places with you in the next minutes.
Thank you so much. I think this will be very helpful for us. I think platform governance is so interesting at the moment, especially because of COVID, of fake news, conspiracy, just to name some of the issues that are coming up. And what was for us mainly noticeable and what we were discussing is that social media platforms as Twitter and Facebook, for example, are kind of undertaking a change of image from a once liberating and democratizing technology to kind of an actual threat to democracy nowadays. So considering this background and the ongoing situation, how would you, first of all, define platform governance and what is the issue with platforms right now?
So I'm going to tackle your questions as it comes to my mind. I think you have a right impression regarding the narrative about platforms, how the internet arises as something to democratize access to information, to democratize production of information and innovation and new services. And we do have currently a different narrative around it, mostly regarding the fact that they do influence a lot in speech and what can and cannot be said online and how that affects democracies, right? But I do not think this is a recent movement. I think this change, this shift in narrative is at least like 4 or 5 years old now. I usually identify this shift beginning with the Snowden revelations, which were not exactly about platform governance specifically. Like, it was very much in the realm of state surveillance, but also of like user data. And then we had all these data leakages throughout the years. And, you know, of course, the disinformation campaigns that happened first in the UK and then in the US and then in Brazil and India and many other countries. So I think this shift in narrative is a process. It's an ongoing process, but it's not a recent one, you know, and perhaps what is a bit more recent is the approach that governments have been taking towards platforms, right? So if I am to focus on what is the issue with platforms right now, I think given everything that has happened, we are at a moment when they are being put on the spotlight by governments, by civil society. People are more engaged, they are more aware of their power and interfering in discourse. And you see that they start to react to this by implementing policies that are supposed to fight what are seen as their undemocratic practices, right? But it is important to notice that even though like this is an issue right now with platforms, it is something that has been going on for a long time. And you will see a lot of people arguing that the reason why it's getting so much attention right now, it's because there's a huge political issue going on in the US. Even what they did to Donald Trump recently, like removing the President of the United States account, this, like, they have blocked politicians and mandated representatives in other countries before. This is not the first time, but it is the first time it happens in the US. There is a lot of attention right now here physically in the global north, because I'm originally from the global south. But it's not like this is an issue of right now. It's a long-standing problem.
Okay, I understand. That's very interesting because I didn't see it from that perspective. And one of the questions that we already prepared and sent you was, what do you think is a key ingredient, if you can say so, to maintain an open discourse on platforms?
I would say that every time we talk about platform regulation, this has to be like a diverse debate, as in everybody should weigh in on this. There's a role for governments, there's a role for platforms themselves, there's a role for users. We will not find a simple solution to that, right? Nowadays, we have these very big private actors that have a lot of power about our personal information, on the way we express ourselves, on what we can or cannot access online. And that has shown to be a problem, right? When they have this amount of power regarding what we access, to the point that we could even argue that a private agent having that sort of power does not fit our democratic pact anymore. Keeping in mind that we're talking about democracies here, because not all places are democracies. But if you do talk about them, what is going on right now does not necessarily fit the democratic pact. So in order to keep an open discourse, I'd say you would need first to keep everyone involved in the debates on how they should be regulated and what should be done. And if you were talking about their practices being open, if you're talking about, people need to be able to say whatever they want in platforms, I'm not even sure that's the right premise, right? Because people are not just allowed to say whatever they want anywhere in a democracy like that. You know, freedom of expression is a fundamental right for democracies. There's no doubt about that, but it's not an absolute one. No right is an absolute one. Mm-hmm. So even freedom of expression can be restrained within legal and constitutional standards when it can harm other people or even harm oneself.
That's interesting, because we were talking about this topic last week, because actually in society we follow some ethical codes, and we were wondering why it seems to be so hard to transcend these codes of behavior from the real life to the virtual interaction.
Yeah. I'm not entirely sure I agree with the premise that people are just more horrible online, because I think they can also be pretty horrible face to face. But I do agree with you that there is an element of anonymity, pseudo anonymity, because at the end of the day, it's not that easy to be absolutely anonymous. And there is also an element of how people relate to each other when they're not in physical presence, right? So, mm-hmm. I could agree with that, but I don't know exactly, and that's because I'm a legal scholar, not a social scientist, but I wouldn't know exactly how to approach this methodologically in order to draw a conclusion that is useful for us. As in, this is what we found out about the behavior online that is different from the behavior in the physical world, and that's how we should approach it. So I wouldn't be able to do that. But when it's time to draw a rule, just call me and I'll help you with that.
Then maybe my next question is already answered, but we thought, wouldn't it be possible for platforms to introduce some kind of ethical code to their platforms and the users?
There is some form of rules already, many forms of rules. A rule doesn't need to be written necessarily, right? So if you consider that, there's like way more rules. The way that the internet's constructed is a ruling in itself, right? The whole idea of regulation by architecture. So to think that we're talking about normless spaces is not the right approach here. These spaces, they are normatized. Perhaps law enforcement and law monitoring, this is not such an easy task. It doesn't happen as much as it should, but there's definitely norms being implemented. So you have the way that these platforms are built. You have the practices that have been embedded in them. And you also have what are close to ethical codes, which are community standards or terms of service. So it's not like they can't write them. They do write them and they do implement them. What I think is the issue right now is that this is not enough. This is clearly not being enough. And the reason why it's not being enough is also arguable. You can say that there's a problem of enforcement, as in we have too many users. We try to do our best to keep up with everything. And to a certain degree, this is also true. But we also have to consider how these business models that profit from engagement also play a big role in this self-regulation not being enough.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it to regulate platforms is kind of a combination of all perspectives, like users and platforms and governments, or is there a specific responsibility on one side?
I think there's definitely a bigger role for governments than they have taken so far. And I don't mean here control of speech, and I don't mean to establish what can or cannot be said online, but I do think there's space for regulatory innovation and implementation of strategies that will actually prove more efficient than doing nothing or than insisting on tools that have proven not only illegitimate because they over-restrict users' fundamental rights at the end of the day, but they also have proved ineffective to actually fight online harms. So I do think there's a space for everyone. And in this sense, the very way that the internet is built proves that, because you cannot implement any rule online that doesn't go through the private actors themselves that constitute the internet. That is why there's a lot of literature that will say that the ideal institutional arrangement for internet regulation is co-regulation, because it presumes that states and private sector would be acting together to make sure that the law is implemented. So it is definitely a hybrid institutional arrangement that has the more potential to, you know, bring internet governance, internet regulation to life.
Could you consider maybe like a independent institution that acts like independent from government, independent from the platform, and kind of independent from the users as a fourth party there to regulate?
Yeah, what would that institution be?
That's what we were discussing in our seminar, and we didn't come to a conclusion, actually.
Yeah, to a certain degree, all institutions will be bound by one actor, right? So the idea that technical independent institutions is actually what fueled I'm not sure here in Europe, but in Brazil where I'm from, we can put this movement right in the 1990s when you start creating what are known as regulatory agencies. I think here in Europe, they will be at least from like the 70s, maybe, I'm not sure. But you do have this movement of creating experts, in theory, independent bodies that would be responsible for regulating. And I have my share of experience working for bodies like this in Brazil. And what I have learned from it is that there will always be governmental bodies for better and for worse. As much as instilling independency mechanisms in these bodies does make a difference and it is important, they will always be a governmental body. And I think the same probably applies to self-regulation bodies. Even the, for instance, the Facebook Oversight Board, right? We haven't seen much of it. So any assessment that we do right now is not going to be necessarily fair. But my instinct is to think that even though it has potential to make decision-making processes more transparent and more democratic, even because it allows for due process, it allows for another instance to appreciate a certain request. I think at the end of the day, it's a self-regulatory body, and that will determine its agenda, that will determine its potential, really, you know, which, as good as it might be, will always be restricted to the scope that does the self-regulatory body determines that it should pursue. So I don't know, what would be an entity independent from government, from civil society, and from everyone? I'm not sure that entity exists. That doesn't mean that self-regulatory or co-regulatory or state bodies would not work. You know, I think there is space to think of frameworks that will work, that can be practical. Always keeping in mind that like the regulation is not an exact science. Regulatory readings will tell you that regulation is a reflexive process. It's like trying what works and getting feedback from the market and trying again and trying to find the right measure of everything, of law enforcement, of sanctions. So yeah, I think there's space for regulatory experimentation, and that does not mean that we need like an absolutely independent body that I'm not even sure could exist.
So a hybrid model could work. What would interest me right now is how would the first steps work for you to regulate in a hybrid model? Who has to take the first steps, for example?
Okay, so there's a lot of steps that have already been taken, right? Not only by governments, but by platforms themselves. Like we are talking about this as if it's a task never tackled and to be started. That's not true. You know, like the internet has been going on for over 3 decades now. And platforms themselves are making rules for over 3 decades now. Their internal processes have been evolving, as also have governmental approaches towards platforms. So there are several steps that have already been taken What we have right now, in my opinion, is possibly a shift in the way states regulate platforms. Some European literature will actually call this a shift already, like a shift from liability to responsibility, a shift from liability to duty. So they basically mean that instead of just being financially liable for whatever harm is caused under certain circumstances, the platform should take a full responsibility for the services they provide embedded in their business models, right? So they need to be transparent, they need to be accountable. So I think this is the shift that is going on now, and I think it's a welcome shift, even though I'm not sure yet that it will deliver the results that it promises. I think that with all its possible advantages, this is still something very much framed in the business models and in the structures of power that have already been established. And I am not sure that a new effective regulatory framework can be implemented within this model without tackling power structures.
Do you think that opinion leaders as state figures and representatives as Trump, for example, should be treated different from other users?
I think there is space for some sort of legal requirements. The way that politicians interact with the public has been regulated in many national frameworks before the internet, right? Bringing that to social media, in my opinion, have a completely different landscape here. Politicians nowadays, they use their social media accounts to communicate with the public all the time. And I think that needs to be taken into consideration. And not only regarding whether their social media accounts need to be blocked, that's not my main concern, to be honest. I think if there are clear standards for what is harm and when harm should be deleted or blocked or flagged, their accounts should also be subject to this sort of standards. But I don't think they could block or delete users from accessing their content, for instance. We have this sort of precedent in the Brazilian experience where the president has blocked even congresswomen and citizens. And if you are an elected representative and you're using your social media account to talk about your mandate, to talk about the public agenda, I don't think that you have the right to block citizens from that country from seeing what you're posting.
Okay, so then the standard should actually apply to generally all users.
I think if presidents publish content that can potentially be harmed, this content should also be flagged. For me, the problem is not that Donald Trump's account was suspended. I think he engaged in dangerous conduct, right? By enabling hate, in enabling criminal acts, and any other user who does it should also be blocked to have their content removed. What we miss here is the standards according to which these decisions are being made. Right? Because as I said before, this is not the first time that happens, and it's not always that these accounts are taken out. So why now? In which standard was it done? Because in my opinion, for instance, it was even too late. I don't argue the final decision, but I think I argue how was this decision reached?
Interesting. So we might consider a more general approach on power structures and platforms in general, and not only specific cases that are maybe put forward through media and Western lenses.
I think that's definitely a factor to be taken into consideration, that the debate is very much focused on what happens in the global north, especially with what happens in the US. You will even find a lot of academics saying that the spread of American social media platforms also important to the American standards for freedom of expression.
Okay, so I think these were all of our questions. Thank you so much for the time and the very interesting conversation. I really learned a lot so far.
So thank you for inviting me and for listening to me, and I wish you much success.
This was Internet Governance Explained. Thank you for listening. You can find us on all the main podcast platforms.